All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's Anti-War Radio on chaosradioaustin.org, lrn.fm, antiwar.com/radio, anomalyradio.com, and I don't know what else anymore. Keep the archives of all the foreign policy interviews, which is almost all the interviews, at antiwar.com/radio. Also, there's such a thing as scotthortonshow.com, where I keep the archives of all my interviews going back to 2003, including the interviews that don't quite make the cut here, like last week's interview of Robert Perry has now been posted. Not Robert Perry. Robert Perry's going to be on the show today. Robert Murphy is who I met from the Mises Institute. That interview only made it to scotthortonshow.com because it was a bit too far afield for antiwar.com purposes, if you take my meaning. Also, there are full show archives at, I think the best thing to do would be to go to my blog and look in the blog roll there for Joe Briggs' archive. He keeps the full archive of this show every day. And, of course, Chaos Radio Austin keeps archives of two-thirds of the show, four-fifths of the time. That is Tuesday through Friday, 2 hours worth of the show with suicidal tendencies instead of commercials. So if you prefer commercials to suicidal tendencies, check out LRN.fm. If you rather rock ST in between hearing me complain about stuff, chaosradioaustin.org is the place for you. Also, there's a chat room. Looks like Sneaker and Mike Hell and Anders and Enemy of the State, Lugosi and a couple others are hanging out there in the chat room. If you go to my blog, thestressblog.com, and you look for the green writing on the front of the page there, that's the instructions how to join up the chat room. It's an IRC free node chat called Anti-War Radio. Oh, I'm also on Facebook and Twitter if you want to follow me on there. Anti-War Scott on Twitter. Anti-War Radio on Facebook. And I think that's it, right? As far as I know. There's a bunch of websites for you to look at. Of course, the most important of those is antiwar.com. The front page there, we keep all the bad news for you all day, every day. And that includes Christmas and Thanksgiving and our mom's birthdays and everything else. We're working 24/7 for you at antiwar.com. And you know what? I don't do this enough. I probably should every day from now on, as long as I'm doing radio. I should point out that antiwar.com needs your help. We do a quarterly fund drive. But really the thing that would help to pull us through is if we could get a bunch of people to sign up to do a monthly donation of 10, 20, 30, 50 bucks. Here's my dues. Now, it's the diamond water problem, right? Marginal utility. If you only have 50 bucks, then we understand that you're not going to give your last 50 bucks to antiwar.com when you need it to put food on your family. However, if you have a whole bunch of different 50 bucks, then it seems reasonable to say, like, hey, you know, why not sign up for the monthly donation and help keep antiwar.com in business? We don't get money from George Soros or from MoveOn.org. Wait, they get all their money from George Soros. We're not backed like these giant foundations. There is no Randolph Bourne fortune that supports antiwar.com. They just named the institute after him because they like him. Because we like him. Randolph Bourne, author of The State. And the unfinished essay from 1916, I think. The unfinished essay, but the first part is finished. War is the health of the state. But Randolph Bourne, when he died of Woodrow Wilson's flu back in during the days of the First World War, he didn't bequeath billions of dollars to be spent on anti-war websites in the future. So anyway, I'm not very good at asking for money, but then again, I'm not ashamed to say that I think antiwar.com deserves to survive. And you know what? If I got to get cut because the budget just won't support my part of it, then fine. I'll just get a real job and then I'll donate to antiwar.com like I used to do back before I worked there. We need it. So, depending on how many diamonds you got compared to how much water you have, see what you can do. Why not go to antiwar.com/donate? You can always email our development director, Angela Keaton, akeaton@antiwar.com. And for that matter, for donation purposes, her phone number is 323-512-7095. So, how do you like that? That's my spiel. And I hope it meant something to you, because we really need the help. Yeah, good. Well, so I still have a few minutes to complain about things before the show starts. Wonderful. Here's what I'm going to celebrate rather than complain about. I'm going to celebrate Glenn Greenwald's complaining about the stupid, evil New York Times, the newspaper of record, all the news that's fit to print, the agenda setters in the American media, as Noam Chomsky points out in his famous book, Manufacturing Consent. The New York Times puts their headline up at like 4 o'clock Eastern. And that's for every paper, every other media organization in the country, so that they know what's supposed to be news tomorrow. The editors of the New York Times decide for everyone what's important and what's not. And if you start seeing a spate of stories about killing in Nigeria, you have to wonder, is there more killing in Nigeria than there used to be? Or are the agenda setters trying to tell me something? It is the most important newspaper, really, in the world, not because of the quality, but because of the lack of it, but because of the position that it's in. It's the most influential paper in the most influential country in the world, to euphemize it almost out of reality. Wait a minute, is euphemize a verb? Can I just say euphemism it right out of reality and change the noun to a verb that way? I don't know. I never was really all that good at conjugation. Anyway, so I'm looking at salon.com/news/opinion/Glenn Greenwald. No. salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. It will forward you on. That's the old address. It goes right to it. More on the media's Pentagon subservient WikiLeaks coverage. I'm sure he means accepting anti-war radio. The New York Times' John Burns yesterday responded to and complained about criticism voiced by me, Julian Assange, and others, that's Glenn Greenwald writing here, over his gossipy People Magazine-style profile of Assange, which his newspaper centrally featured as part of its coverage of the WikiLeaks document release. In a self-justifying interview with Yahoo News' Michael Calderon, Burns makes several comments worth examining. Burns says he doesn't recall ever having been the subject of such absolutely relentless interpretation following a story in his 35 years at the Times. He said his email inbox has been full of denunciations from readers and a number of academics at top-tier schools such as Harvard, Yale, and MIT. Some, he said, used, quote, language that I don't think they would use at their own dinner table. Greenwald writes, "This is really good to hear, quite encouraging. Apparently many people became quite angry when the newspaper, which did more to enable the attack on Iraq than any other media outlet in the world, covered one of the most significant war leaks in American history, documents detailing the deaths of more than 100,000 human beings in that war and the heinous abuse of thousands of others, by assigning its most celebrated war correspondent and London bureau chief to studiously examine and malign the totally irrelevant personality quirks, alleged mental health, and various personal relationships of Julian Assange." Imagine that. Then we have this from Burns. "Such heated reactions to the profile," Burns says, "shows just how embittered American discourse on these two wars has become." More Greenwald when we get back after this.
I'm Angela Keaton for LibertyStickers.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and, I think I'm going to keep reading this. Glenn Greenwald making fun of John Burns at the New York Times. Got some horrible reporters at the New York Times. Some of the very worst people in the whole world, actually, are so-called reporters at the New York Times. John Burns is one of them. But then, of course, there's Michael R. Gordon, David Sanger, and William J. Broad. Now, I usually say Broad and Sanger because it sounds better to have the first syllable name first and the one-syllable name first, sorry, and the two-syllable name second. But no, Sanger surely is far worse. And in fact, we've seen the evidence here on this show. When William J. Broad writes an article with Mark Mazzetti, then there's truth in it. Go figure. But whenever his name is stuck to David Sanger's, there's this giant cloud of disgrace that follows him around. Poor guy. But apparently, he is capable of reporting true things if you team him up with Mark Mazzetti, that William J. Broad. But when it comes to telling the lies that matter the most, there's always Michael R. Gordon and David Sanger. Anyway, here's Glenn Greenwald continuing to pick on John Burns of the New York Times because he deserves it. Here's Burns complaining how the American discourse about these two wars has become embittered. And Greenwald writes at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald, "Oh my, how upsetting. People are so very embittered, and over what? Just a couple of decade-long wars that have spilled enormous amounts of innocent blood, devastated two countries for no good reason, and spawned a worldwide American regime of torture, lawless imprisonment, and brutal occupation. It's nothing to get upset over. People really need to lighten up and stop being so mean to John Burns. That's what really matters. After all, as he himself told you just a couple of months ago, there was just no way that he and his war-supporting media colleagues, holding themselves out as preeminent, not to be questioned experts on that country, could possibly have known that an attack on Iraq would have led to such devastating violence and humanitarian catastrophe, except by listening to, rather than systematically ignoring, the huge numbers of people around the world loudly warning that exactly that could happen. The last thing you should have to endure are insulting emails from people who seem to think that such episodes warrant anger and recrimination. And that's to say nothing of the obvious irony of a reporter complaining about our embittered discourse after he just wrote one of the sleaziest, most vicious hit pieces seen in the New York Times in quite some time. Then there's this. The profile of Assange, the public face of WikiLeaks, Burns said, is a, quote, absolutely standard journalistic endeavor that we would use with any story of similar importance in the United States. Burns added that the Times is not in the business of hagiography, but in the business of giving our readers the fullest context for these documents and the Assange motivations. To suggest that doing that is some kind of grotesque journalistic sin and makes me a sociopath, Burns said, strikes me as pretty odd. Greenwald continues here. This is the heart of the matter. What Burns did to Julian Assange is most certainly not a standard journalistic endeavor for the New York Times. If anyone doubts that, please show me any article that paper has published which trashed the mental health, psyche, and personality of a high-ranking American political or military official, a senator, or a general, or a president, or a cabinet secretary, or even a prominent lobbyist, based on quotes from disgruntled associates of theirs. That is not done, and it never would be. This kind of character smear, he's not in his right mind, pronounced a 25-year-old who sort of knows him, is reserved for people who don't matter in the world of establishment journalists, i.e. people without power or standing in Washington, D.C., and especially those whom the American government officials, authorities scorn. In official Washington, Assange is a contemptible loser. The Pentagon hates him and wants him destroyed. That's a link to proof. And therefore, the reporters who rely on, admire, and identify with the Pentagon immediately adopt that perspective. And that's why he was the target of this type of attack. After I wrote my criticism, this is Greenwald I'm reading here, After I wrote my criticism of this article on Monday, I was contacted by Burns co-writer Ravi Somaiya, who defended this article for my criticisms. I agreed to keep the exchange off the record at his insistence, and I will do so. But that was the question I kept asking. Point to any instance where the NYT ever subjected, all capitals in here, someone who matters in Washington, to this kind of personality and mental health trashing based on gossip and the condemnation of associates. It does not exist. As for Burns' pronouncement that the Times is not in the business of hagiography, he should probably remind himself of what he himself wrote about the Right Honorable General Stanley McChrystal after Burns had attacked Michael Hastings for daring to publish the general's own statements that reflected badly on him. Here's what Burns wrote while falling all over himself in reverence of this great American warrior. This is now Greenwald extensively quoting the New York Times' John Burns. All I know about General McChrystal suggests that he is, just as the Rolling Stone article suggested, a maverick of high self-belief and intensity. Uncautioned in his disregard for the conventional, but for all that, a soldier with a deep belief in the military's ideals of duty, honor, country. Sorry, switching up. Paragraphs and syllables and things. Though handed what many would regard as a poison chalice in the Afghanistan command, he has worked relentlessly to rescue America's fortunes there. Grave misfortune it is, considering what is lost to America and a commander as smart, resolute, and fit for purpose as General McChrystal. And he goes on like this. More praise. It's too long of a block quote to read the whole thing. But here we go. It's safe to say, wrote John Burns, as quoted by Glenn Greenwald, it's safe to say that many of the men and women who have covered General McChrystal as commander in Afghanistan or in his previous role as the top U.S. Special Forces commander admired him and felt at least some unease about the elements in the Rolling Stone article that ended his career. Greenwald now writes, it seems Burns wrote that while standing and saluting in front of a large wall photograph of the general, or perhaps kneeling in front of it. The only hint of criticism was quite backhanded, that McChrystal blundered catastrophically by failing to exercise sufficient caution when speaking to an unestablished, unaccepted, reckless, low-level loser like Michael Hastings, who simply did not know or refuse to abide by the general protecting rules that real reporters use when covering top military officials. And despite writing 2,700 praise-filled words about McChrystal, Burns never once mentioned little things like his central involvement in the Pat Tillman fraud or the widespread detainee abuse in Iraq under his command until a reader asked about it, and only then he mentioned it in passing to dismiss it. Burns' view of McChrystal is the very definition of journalistic hagiography. And it keeps going, and it keeps getting better. And that's one thing I really enjoy about reading Glenn Greenwald is his specific media criticisms and attacking specific reporters like this when they deserve it. Salon.com/opinion/... All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. We're on chaosradioaustin.org, lrn.fm, antiwar.com/radio, anomalyradio.com, and God knows what else. Here's my recommendation to you, because I think it's important. You go check out consortiumnews.com. That's the home for the journalism of, a few favorites, but most especially Robert Perry. He's the author of Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush, and I forget the rest of his books off the top of my head, but welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Oh, here we have Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth. And I guess maybe most of you guys know, or hopefully Bob did the groundbreaking work on Iran-Contra in the 1980s for the AP and for Newsweek, and really probably is the nation's expert on especially GOP criminality over the last generation and a half or so. So really appreciate you joining us here, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
And now, I also really appreciate the fact that you have the spotlight article on antiwar.com today. Records cast doubt on Iraq surge. I suppose you've been digging through the WikiLeaks.
Well, there are a lot of them, so a lot of documents, so it's a little hard for us to do them all, but I have been going through some and of course reading what has also been available based on them.
All right, so now I guess I don't mind beating this dead horse because it seems to me like the slogan, the surge is working, the surge is working, and then the surge worked, was beaten into everybody's head. As much as it could have possibly been by the Pentagon, a.k.a. the media, or I'm not sure where you draw the line in there, Bob, but that's the slogan. And if the surge worked, it certainly worked as a slogan, as a brand name that was sold to the American people, sort of like Barack Obama. But I wonder, you know, it seems from your analysis here, you don't really buy that the slogan actually portrays reality, huh?
Well, no, and I think the WikiLeaks documents tend to show that there were a number of factors that fed into the gradual decline in violence in Iraq, which is a view that that we've reported on previously, based on our own reporting, and that people like Bob Woodward uncovered when he was doing his book that dealt with the surge period, that many inside the U.S. Pentagon even were saying that this was not the case, that a lot of factors were involved, including the things that predated the surge. If you remember, the view of Petraeus' predecessors, Abizaid and Casey, were that by maintaining a smaller U.S. footprint, yet being aggressive in certain other ways, like going after some of the al-Qaeda leadership, that things would be brought under control. There was also the sectarian violence, which is now clear was also fading really by the time the surge got going, in the sense that there had been a sort of effectively ethnic cleansing that had occurred in Iraq. So the two sects, the Shiites and the Sunnis, had been rather very messily separated. There also been success in going after the al-Qaeda leadership. Zarqawi was killed in June of 2006, if you remember. And so you had a number of factors that were setting the stage for a decrease in violence. And they weren't always obviously good ones. There was an awful lot of simple wearing down of the Iraqi population through this endless violence that the Bush administration had unleashed on their country. There was a real desire among many Iraqis, as reflected in these new documents that have come out, for finding some kind of way to tamp down the violence themselves. So this whole myth that because George Bush courageously in January and February of 2007 ordered up the surge, and that General Petraeus went in and with the extra 30,000 or so U.S. troops and suddenly brought everything under control, was always been a myth. It was always a PR campaign, mostly. And it was a way for the neocons, who had, of course, been a big part of the invasion and all the happy talk that preceded it, the cakewalks and how the U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators, et cetera, that they used the surge through their prestige positions inside the Washington media to say, gee, we've been vindicated. See, we were right. And then, frankly, Barack Obama, who had opposed the surge as a senator, was then pounded during the 2008 campaign by the media, demanding that he admit that John McCain was right about the surge. And Obama at first would say, that no, it's more complicated than that, which is sort of the right answer. But with George Stephanopoulos and Katie Couric baiting him and being constantly harassed, he, showing, I guess, some of the things we've gotten to know of him as president, thought that it was better to just give in and say, yes, the surge worked beyond our wildest dreams. So you had kind of this imposed false reality, which one might say, well, gee, why does that matter at this point? But the surge was then used to justify what's happened in Afghanistan. That is the escalation, secondly, another surge in Afghanistan with General Petraeus, who was declared the hero and the great victor in Iraq, put in charge of Afghanistan. So we're seeing there are real results and consequences when a false analysis is imposed. And obviously we saw one back in 2002 and 2003 with the certainty about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But in a way, the surge was another phase of that, where a misleading or incomplete or false reality was imposed on the American public, and it's had its consequences.
Well, now, you think it might be a fair analysis to say that when Petraeus talked about part of his mission being adding time to the Washington clock, that maybe that was really just the mission, that, you know, you had the Baker Commission and all this, where even, you know, that was really the establishment, Sandra Day O'Connor and James Baker III and Vernon Jordan and all these people. And they were saying, let's get out by spring 08. And the American people had elected the Democrats, to the House and the Senate in order to force an end to the war in 2006. The American people were really sick and tired of it, and he needed to find a way to make it okay to stay forever. That was basically what the surge was about, wasn't it?
Well, I'm not sure the U.S. will stay forever. I think the Iraqi people...
yeah, but that wasn't the question. The question was whether that was what the Pentagon and architects were up to.
Sure, I do think that was part of the real fear of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney was that they would leave office the perceived clear-cut losers, having lost a war in Iraq, and they didn't want that, so they needed to sort of stretch things out so they could let some of these other factors, which had begun, for instance, the Sunni awakening, the turning against Al Qaeda, was occurring also in 2006 with the payments from the U.S. And of course the Sadr and the Shiite militias did a unilateral ceasefire. So there are a lot of factors that were already in play or going into play when the surge was starting. But it was a way to buy time and to change the narrative. And I think that changing the narrative was very important to the neocons in particular, because they needed to reestablish themselves as the experts on national security in Washington, which they had somewhat lost with the problems that the Iraq war had brought on. So I think you had a number of factors going there. But yeah, I think the idea was, how do you get this game to go longer, and how do you keep the American people engaged?
Now, there's the music playing, so we're going to have to go out to this break. But I want to ask you when we get back about the Sunni based insurgency's attempt to make a deal. And I don't remember all the articles anymore, but I think one time, Bob, I went through and showed with different pieces of journalism from different times that the Sunnis had tried to make the same Anbar Awakening type deal the entire war, 2003, 4, 5, and 6, and finally it was accepted in 07.
On Free Talk Live, we talked...
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with the great Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. We're talking about the surge, the history of the Iraq War, especially around 2007. But can you verify for me, am I right? Do you remember, is that right, that really didn't start out this way, but quickly became the predominantly Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, that they had tried to make a deal with the Americans that, look, just patrol us or let us patrol our own neighborhoods and stop killing us and we'll stop killing you. In the summer of 03, 04, 05, and finally in 06, the generals started to decide to accept their offer after the Civil War was lost, basically.
Well, there were elements of the Sunni side of Iraq that were eager to figure out some way to deal with the Americans after Saddam Hussein was ousted. However, as you remember, there was this very imperious approach taken by the neocon-led U.S. occupation, which was going to essentially remake Iraq in some free market neocon desired image. And that's what sort of created this this other dynamic where it became clear that the interests of the Iraqis were going to be essentially overridden. And that did push some of the Sunnis into greater and greater resistance. And it was only after the occupation had essentially failed that there was a sufficient rebellion among the Iraqis and then spreading from the not just the Sunnis but into some elements of the Shiite population, that the U.S. commanders essentially said, we're not going to push this extreme political ideological agenda. We're going to try to work something out. And that's where you had Generals Casey and Generals Abizaid beginning to reach out and accept some of these peace overtures from the Sunnis. And effectively, they were given money and allowed to patrol their own areas in exchange rejecting al-Qaeda. And that's began to lead to at least some relative peace in the western part of Iraq. Obviously, there was also during this phase, because of the rivalries that were unleashed by the U.S. occupation between the Sunnis and the Shiites, the civil war followed, and you had this horrible mess, this nightmare situation across the country. And eventually, that was also burning out because of the separation of the two sides. And that's why when Bush came in with the surge, whether it was a slight help, I mean, I think it might have actually been a harm, because by adding additional U.S. troops and being more aggressive in the use of a counterinsurgency approach, which we saw most dramatically in that WikiLeaks released video of the attack on those that group of Iraqi men, including two Reuters newsmen, just eventually slaughtering them for no particular reason. That was sort of a symbol of, or an indication of what the ground reality really was in Iraq, this kind of utter brutality and indiscriminate violence. But that was part of what the surge brought too. So eventually it calmed down. But to then credit the surge is the big mistake, because much of this would have happened, I think, whether the surge occurred or didn't occur. And in fact, the surge may have made things worse and even delayed the more peaceful situation that ultimately prevailed.
Now, there's so many things. I mean, it's a giant years-long war. But as long as you mention that collateral murder video, I talked to two guys from that brigade or battalion or whichever. I don't know all these things because I'm not a vet. But anyway, they both said that their boss, Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich, along with General McChrystal, was involved in the Pat Tillman cover-up and, any other things anyway. But the point is this. They both told me on this show that they heard him specifically, both of them, from him to them, not passed through a sergeant or something. They heard him instruct their group that if there's an IED attack, you just shoot 360 degrees, kill anything that moves that can possibly be around. How a lot of them disobey the order and would just shoot up in the air, things like that. But he was ordering them to commit war crimes, 360 degree rotational fire. And then I'll add one more thing to that. It's the entire team is described, and their time in Iraq is described in the book, The Good Soldiers by David Finkel. And as we were talking about with Gareth Porter on the show yesterday, at no time does anyone in this entire brigade, including Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich, seem to understand that as they're fighting the Sadarists, they're in the middle of, or at least they just finished fighting a civil war basically on behalf of Muqtada al-Sadr and his allies in the Iraqi National Alliance. And here they are, as Gareth Porter put it, they just need an excuse to fight the war. The war against the Sunni insurgency was over. They had to fight somebody. So here they're fighting this guy who's an integral part of the government that we installed in power there, and is obviously the guy who, more than even Sistani, it looks like, will be inheriting the power, at least from Baghdad to Basra, when we finally go, Bob.
Well, I think all those points are well taken. I think the collateral murder video does give you a sense of that. There was this attitude, which was part of the surge approach, but it preceded it as well, to basically kill the so-called MAMs, military age males. There was almost if you had any excuse, you could do it. And that's clear from a number of cases that have been brought where there were times where courts martial were held against soldiers for excessive violence, but in almost every case, the soldiers simply said, we were following the rules of engagement. And they were essentially vindicated. They were let off. Sometimes they'd be nailed for something like lying to their superiors or planting a weapon on a victim. But in terms of the actual killing of the people, that was just part of the rules of engagement. They were extremely loose. And during the surge, they seemed to have gotten even looser, where there was this kind of encouragement to just basically take out people. And I think any country that suffers under that, as much as we may think, oh, that the people want to rebel and stand up against it, but terror does, as tyrants have learned across time in history, terror at some point works. That you can intimidate a population through violence to such a level that eventually they don't want to continue anymore. And that was kind of what happened here. That was another element of the ending of this, at least the worst phases of the war in Iraq. But I think overall that is quite a dismal and horrible situation that we tend to ignore. We tend in this effort to sort of declare victory in Iraq, this unseemly effort that we saw a cover of Newsweek some months ago, victory in Iraq finally. And the celebrations of the neocons in Washington saying they were finally vindicated and shown that they were right all along, it ignores the fact that there were substantial war crimes committed by the United States, by the Bush administration most directly, but involving large numbers of American troops, involving now to some degree the Obama administration. In the continuation of some of this, so it's not by simply declaring victory. It's one of those situations where you have to think that this was an immoral and rather disastrous experience, and should be seen like that for all involved, and not with this group jumping around saying that they had won, they've been proven to be right all along, and that the surge worked.
Yeah, well, and even I guess when Woodward's book came out about all this, it came out that really it was General Keane and these others who had come up with the surge strategy, and I guess they just brought Fatneck Fred Kagan and the AEI crew along for the ride in order that the neocons could get some credit, even though really they just came in to put their name on it at the end. Isn't that right? Give me a yes or no there, because we're almost out of time.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure all the details, but that's true. Those two people certainly were involved. Keane had the idea, and Kagan helped sell it.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, there's a couple more things here real quick. There are reports that, look, oh my God, weapons of mass destruction were found after all, but isn't it the case that all those were simply weapons that had been declared by Iraq and turned over to the international inspectors, UNSCOM and UNMOVIC and the IAEA, et cetera, and were under seal? And we're just sitting there inert, doing nothing in Iraq, left in Iraq by the UN, and they didn't get in the hands of anybody to do any fighting with until the U.S. invaded and destroyed the security system in that country, right?
There were no caches of WMD discovered. There were some residual weapons that, you know, mustard gas and so forth, that were found in a few places, but these were not part of any weaponry that the Iraqi military was going to use.
Yeah, I saw in Wired, on the Danger blog, they had these quotes from these people. They didn't seem to highlight the significance of the soldiers saying, yeah, we came to the store place and the seals had been broken, the UN seals. Just like that story about some yellow cake was removed a few years back. But it was under UN seal the whole time. And I guess we don't have time to address the Afghan surge metaphor, but suffice it to say, we're not fighting for the majority in Afghanistan, and they won't be able to save the surge war there, Bob.
Thanks, Scott.
See you, man.
Uncovering this.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And our next guest is Matthew Rothschild. He is, I think, editor of The Progressive. That's Progressive. .org, and I've got three important articles to direct your attention to, including a new one. But here is Leahy concerned about Northcom's new army unit. That's from October 7th, 2008, at progressive.org. Then there is, what is Northcom up to? This is from November the 12th, 2008. And now the brand new one, the Pentagon advances on America, October 21, 2010. There may be more on this topic, but those are three good ones for you. Welcome back to the show, Matthew. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's always nice for you to have me on.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today. So I guess, first of all, take us back then to 2008. Or in fact, maybe we need to take us back to 1998 when Bill Clinton created the Northern Command for the United States in the first place, or at least tried to, right?
Well, he may have tried to, but it was actually George W. who got the thing established on October 1st, 2002.
So this is basically kind of like having AFRICOM and having CENTCOM. This is how the Pentagon divides the worlds into different command responsibilities of battle space, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, before 9/11, I mean, the most common command was the U.S. Southern Command. I think that a lot of political people understood was the way the Pentagon tried to intervene in Central America and South America through SOUTHCOM, which was in Panama for a long time. And then there's CENTCOM, or U.S. Central Command, which has jurisdiction, Pentagon jurisdiction anyway, over the whole Middle East and Afghanistan. And it was Petraeus who was in charge of CENTCOM there before he was sent over to replace McChrystal over in Afghanistan. And so now we have NORTHCOM, and that should strike people as odd, because the Pentagon is not supposed to be patrolling the streets or the skies of the United States. I mean, we have something called the Posse Comitatus Act, which has been on the books for more than 120 years, which says that the military cannot be involved in law enforcement here in the United States. But after 9/11, Bush was able to push through this and establish the U.S. Northern Command. And one of the astonishing things, which is what Leahy was concerned about, was this idea that, not an idea, it's actually a fact, that NORTHCOM has its own dedicated fighting force. It got the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, 1st Brigade Combat Team, 4,700 people who actually had experience fighting in Baghdad and patrolling Ramadi in Iraq, and now they're deputized to the U.S. Northern Command. This may be illegal, actually. It hasn't been challenged yet, but the ACLU is worried about it. I'm worried about it. Senator Leahy's worried about it.
Well, now, if I remember right from the Onion headline back in 2003, George Bush bravely leads 3rd Infantry into battle in Iraq, I think they were the tip of the spear of the American invasion, the 3rd Infantry Division,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they were one of the first.
The old Big Red One, the 1st Infantry from back before.
Yeah, they were right there at the front lines.
All right, well, now there's a few things to go over here. First of all, you talked about the Posse Comitatus Act. Can you give us a little bit of history for people who don't speak Latin and aren't too familiar with, say, 19th century American war history?
Well, it was a law that was put on the books to keep the Army post-Reconstruction era from patrolling the streets, essentially. And that's been on the books for a long time. The Bush administration tried to change it, and actually did for a little bit. And then Leahy himself of Vermont was able to pass a law that would put the military back into its box, but it seems to be jumping out of that box right now.
And now I'm sitting here scratching around inside my brain trying to come up with the name of the Supreme Court case, but I'm going to get it wrong, so maybe I'll just stay quiet on that. But at some point, I think right after the Civil War, the Supreme Court ruled that martial law is unavailable as a power to be exercised by the executive as long as the courts are still open for business. And I think they were directly addressing habeas corpus, but they were basically saying, well, like, for example, what happened to Jose Padilla, you can't do that. As long as the country is not in such a state of internal convulsion that the judges are still able to make it to the office in the morning, they have the priority.
Well, I hope that's still the law of the land, but I have some doubts about that. One of the doubts is National Security Presidential Directive 51 that Bush signed when he was in office, that gives the President of the United States the power over all three branches of the government, not just the executive branch, but also Congress and the judiciary in times of an emergency that the President himself would declare. So there are a lot of things on the books that especially came on the books during Bush and Cheney's reign that are just sitting there waiting for another chief executive who wants to, you know, haul them out and really destroy our democracy. And having NORTHCOM at the chief executive, the commander-in-chief's disposal would be, you know, something that president, if he or she is malicious and undemocratic, could use.
Yeah, and you know what? What I thought it was actually right. The Milligan case. That was the Supreme Court decision where they said martial rule can never exist where the courts are open and then the proper and unobstructed exercise of their jurisdiction is also confined to the locality of actual war. So, but I guess then that's begging the question, isn't it? But here's my thing. Tea parties here and left-wing eco-activists there or something. What internal threat is there? Don't tell me the mosque-building Muslims in New York are going to be the target of this. Which Americans could George Bush or Barack Obama possibly conceive of using this 3rd Infantry Division against? Matthew, do you think?
I just don't know. I mean, that's the puzzle and that's the worry. There was a discussion in the Bush administration by Homeland Security. Actually, a contract went out to Halliburton to build detention camps for illegal immigrants or undocumented workers. And that's always a fear that I have, that there are going to be roundups if this climate gets any worse. I mean, we're seeing a lot of nastiness coming out of Arizona and spreading across the country about people who are here without proper papers. And it doesn't take a wild imagination to see that things could really go down an ugly slope here in the United States. And then to have all that power at the hands of the president with the Northern Command at its disposal is a concern. I mean, last year, the Northern Command tried to get Congress to allow it to dispatch 400,000 troops across the country in times of an emergency and to let the Secretary of Defense, not even the president, authorize it at his or her own discretion. So, I mean, it's not like the Pentagon is not thinking of these things.
Yeah, it's just like Robert Higgs wrote in his book, Crisis and Leviathan. You have this ratchet effect where no matter how bad these people fail, since they have a monopoly on doing their supposed job, all they can ever do is get more power. So if 9/11 sits there and happens while they're sitting there on their watch, then they get a Patriot Act, they get an Office of Homeland Security, then the 9/11 Commission comes out and says just what a poor job they did, they get a Department of Homeland Security out of that, then Hurricane Katrina comes and drowns New Orleans, and George Bush says, you people are right, you know what, Brownie didn't do that good of the job, from now on we need to put the Army first, they're the ones that we can trust to really get things done, and every time something horrible happens, the rule of law dies a little more, and the power of the imperial presidency grows, and not just over Iraqis and Afghans and Pakistanis and Somalis, but over us here.
And this is what government and bureaucracy is hostile to giving up power. Rather, they want to accumulate power. And now that power has been accumulated in the executive branch, you don't see Obama giving it up. And so it's just going to lie there waiting for the next person to abuse it, assuming that Obama doesn't abuse it. I don't think Obama will abuse it in any kind of dictatorial way, though I know there's these conspiracy people on the right think that's going to happen any second. Now, that's not how I read Obama, but I do have some real concerns if, a Sarah Palin became president.
Sure. Well, and, for the people who, come from the other point of view, think this is perfectly fine when it's George Bush or if it's Sarah Palin, but don't trust it with Obama, the point is the same, right? That, violence in this society is supposed to be distributed by law, not by the will of some man up there on a high chair.
Absolutely. And where were they when Bush was grabbing all this power?
Right. Well, and, there's plenty of real concern for the Constitution and plenty of hypocrisy on all sides to go around, it seems like to me. But I'm really glad that The Progressive is good on this issue. It's some of the best journalism on it. We'll be back with Matthew Rothschild after this. Anti-War Radio.
So, you want to move to New Hampshire for
a nervous breakdown? My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm gonna go berserk. I'm crazy and I'm hurt.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Website is antiwar.com/radio, chaosradioaustin.org, lrn.fm. All over your FM dial, KUCR in Riverside. Soon enough, I'll have my own show on KPFK. It's biding my time. Almost there. All right, we're talking with Matthew Rothschild from The Progressive. And by the way, Matthew, did I say it right that you're the editor of The Progressive?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just didn't have your bio in front of me. I wanted to make sure I had it right.
I'll answer to that.
Yeah, there you go. Good. It's a good thing to take responsibility for. All right, so now here's the thing. You're talking about, again, 4,700 men of the 3rd Infantry Division now basically active duty, maybe just sitting somewhere waiting to be used for something, but they're on the case, these Iraq war veterans, hardened, battle-hardened soldiers here. It all sort of seems like it's an anvil on the windowsill up there waiting to fall on our head, but it hadn't quite been pushed yet. And I wonder, is this the kind of thing where you think, like, say there was another September 11th-sized attack. Do you think that would just be it, and they would just say, well, there is no Constitution anymore. It's military rule now. Like Tommy Franks told Cigar Aficionado, one more attack and we'll have a military form of government in this country. Is that where we're headed here, really?
Well, that's a big concern, and it wasn't just Tommy Franks, but it was Wayne Downing, who was Condoleezza Rice's deputy at the National Security Council, who said if the United States is attacked again with weapons of mass destruction, we're going to have to suspend the Constitution. And so, they were right up front about that. And Bob Woodward himself had heard people talking about that, too. And I heard him give a graduation speech a few years back where he said, we need to pay more attention to this because this is what these guys have in store for us. And yet there haven't been a lot of people paying attention to it.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? As long as we're talking about it, I happen to have a clip here. It's just 1 minute long from the days of the Iran-Contra scandal back in the 1980s. And this is Congressman Jack Brooks, a Democrat from Texas, attempting to ask Oliver North about a plan to suspend the Constitution, and in this case is the Rex 84 and Operation Garden Plot and all that. People can read about it, and it's a lot like what you talked about with those contracts for Halliburton to build presumably temporary camps for mass roundups of immigrants. Well, the idea was if there was in this case, if there was too much domestic dissent among Latinos about a full-scale invasion of Nicaragua, then this is what we would have to resort to, and they came up with a plan for it. And I just like sharing this exchange with people because I know most have never heard it. It's from the movie The Panama Deception. Why didn't it go in? Okay, well, my iTunes decided to stop working, so never mind.
I mean, the other thing that...
What a waste of a piece of interview there.
Too bad. I wanted to hear it. But listen, there was also back in 2008, a member of Congress, a California representative named Brad Sherman, said, this is right as Lehman Brothers had crashed and the whole economy on Wall Street was going down. Congressman Brad Sherman said, he was told that if they don't hold their nose and vote for this bank bailout, there was going to be martial law. This is a member of Congress using that term. So I think we need to take this seriously and see what structures are in place that would enable the President of the United States to do that and demand of our members of Congress that they hold hearings on this so that we can see what they have in store for us and so that we can try to prevent it before it happens, because once it happens, it's too late.
Yeah, well, in a way it seems kind of fantastical and unrealistic. You got 18,000 separate sheriff's departments and city police agencies and that kind of thing. But then again, there was a civil war in America before. 600,000 people killed. It's not completely unprecedented,
Well, and one thing to consider, especially if the Republicans take over in Congress, is to see whether they are going to sponsor this bill that would give the Pentagon the authority to deploy almost 400,000 troops in this country in times of emergency. Actually, Obama's Pentagon was trying to do that too, but maybe this is one of those things where they're going to get bipartisan agreement, God forbid, because this would allow the Secretary of Defense to call up the troops, and it would allow the President to call up the troops in times of an emergency.
You say up to 400,000, half a million soldiers almost.
Yeah. Just about 400,000.
I mean, that's as many documents just came out in the biggest document leak ever.
Yeah, but these are documents.
That's a lot of soldiers.
These are documents with guns.
That's more than double what was the highest number of soldiers in the Iraq War at any given time.
Yeah. So
even including the Mercs.
I mean, it's just I mean, you should look at the legislation that was drafted, and we have it on our website, this idea about the Pentagon having wanting the power to call up all these troops. I mean, it would give the Secretary of Defense and the President at their own discretion, after they call an emergency for all sorts of possible things, you know, to have the Army in our streets. And that's just not supposed to be our system of government.
All right. Well, I think I got that clip working, so let's take a listen here.
Yeah.
I don't know if in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster?
Mr. Chairman.
I believe the question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch upon that, sir?
I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was the area in which he had worked. I believe
I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, certain arrangements can be made for an executive session.
Okay, so that was Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii saying, no, 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 we're not going to talk about this here in front of everybody.
Isn't that beautiful? I mean, what should be more public than a discussion of whether we're going to still have a democracy in our country or not? But
yeah.
No, they had to take that off the table.
Well, you know, in a way, at this point, I wonder maybe if we could be better off if they quit pretending that there was a constitution that granted them legitimacy and quit pretending there was a rule of law that applied to them when clearly it doesn't. Government employees can murder whoever they want. They can torture whoever they want. They can lie us into war. They don't even have to declare it. They can set up a military garrison like you're talking about right in the heart of our country, and no law can stop them. Why keep pretending?
Well, I mean, certainly we're not a democracy the way we're supposed to be right now. There's no doubt about that. And the question is, who would stop or who would be able to stop a president who tries to call out the troops and take control of the country? Remember when Nixon was about to be impeached, there were big questions as to, you know, what's going to happen if Nixon calls, you know, the 82nd Airport and has them surround the White House and prevent the Supreme Court from nabbing him, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the kind of things that people do fighting about war powers. We've seen it throughout history. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your journalism on this particular issue, especially, Matthew. And thank you for your time on the show.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Let's keep watching.
All right, everybody. That's Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, progressive.org.
This is novelist Tom Robbins.
Subdivision sectors after curfew will be shot. Remain calm. Do not panic. Your neighborhood watch officer will be by to collect urine samples in the morning. Anyone caught interfering with the collection of urine samples will be shot. Stay in your home. Remain calm. The number one enemy of progress is question. National security is more important than individual will. All sports broadcasts will proceed as normal. No more than two people without permission. Use only the drug prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question. The comfort you've demanded is now mandatory. Be happy! At last, everything is done for you.
All right, so that was Jello Biafra off of Ice-T album from back in the days. There was one version of that that my friend Chance had on vinyl where he says, anyone caught not displaying their velvet rug of Alexander Haig on their living room wall will be shot. That's sort of an inside joke for those who remember when Ronald Reagan was shot and George Bush, the vice president, conveniently was out of the country at the time. Need an alibi much, dude? And so someone on TV, one of the reporters, asked the White House crew, well, what's going on? Who's in charge? Who's the president right now? And Alexander Haig said, I am in control. I am in the chair, even though he was just the Secretary of State at the time. And if Reagan is shot and Bush is out of the country, then according to the Constitution, which is presumably the law, then the Speaker of the House is in charge. And if not him, then the President Pro Tem of the Senate. And then if not him, the Secretary of State. Anyway. So, yeah, I'm Scott. This is Anti-War Radio. Coming up here in a little while, I'll be talking with Christopher Ketchum. And we'll be talking about breaking up the United States into little pieces so that maybe we can be free. You know, if we have to suffer under these aggressive monopoly governments, these states with these boundaries and their illegitimate claims on the right to use aggressive force within those lines, maybe we could make those lines smaller at least. Maybe we could define down their number of tasks and jobs that we want them to do for us, and maybe then we could actually control them a little bit, you know? Maybe then we could focus on just a few problems, like we don't want a Northern Command. We want a Northern Command even less than we want a war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen. You know, stuff like that. But anyway, hey, back to making fun of the New York Times, the newspaper of record, all the news that's fit to print, the number one source of historians in the future looking back on this era. That's what they'll do, is they'll go through the New York Times. They'll read John Burns and Michael Gordon and David Sanger to find out what's true. And something that's been of great consternation to people and really a matter of great hilarity to others at other times has been the New York Times' refusal to use the word torture whenever they're describing the Bush or Obama administration's torturing of people. And it's gotten so ridiculous now with the new war logs that are all about torture and all about Donald Rumsfeld commanding the military that they are to approve of torture. To not only turn a blind eye to torture by the Wolf Brigades and Badr Brigades and so-called Iraqi army of, you know, mostly Shiite death squads and the Mahdi army as well, that they used against the Sunni insurgency, which only made it worse and worse and worse. Despite the fact that WikiLeaks has now released 400,000 documents that, you know, a great many, hundreds of which at least, are about just this very thing. U.S. soldiers writing to their bosses. Yeah, today we had to turn over our prisoners to some guys that were pretty sure we're going to torture them to death. And they had an order called FRAGO 242, Fragmentary Order 242, that said, so what? Big deal. Never mind. And we're not talking about even, CIA tortures, which if you read the Red Cross report, if you read all the different journalism that came out, especially last year, about the details of how it was that they tortured Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, many innocent people as well, that's nothing compared to having the Wolf Brigade put drills through people's skulls, through their shoulders, through their hands, through whatever. Electrocuting them to death. And hey, I don't mean to acquit the CIA. Who knows what they really did? Who knows the worst of it? I'm not saying, you know, not them. But some really medieval torture. There's nothing else you could call it but torture, but the New York Times won't call it torture. So at boingboing.net, in this 21st century wonderful digital age that we live in, they've come up with an automatic New York Times torture euphemism generator. boingboing.net/2010/10/22/torture. Just look it up. The New York Times torture euphemism generator. Reports of possible conversational information integration solicitations. Intense coaxing inquests. Meatbag tenderizing procedures. Electric sad time. Imposing truth-finding diagnostics. War toll includes bothersome submersion exactions. Leaked war logs reveal imposing phenomenological inspections. Phenomenological? I can't say it. Prisoners experienced intimidating interrogation applications. Evidence suggests heightened sleepover inquests. War toll includes augmented research evaluations. Leaked war logs reveal imposing interrogation ultimata. War toll includes bothersome coaxing remonstrations, tribulating toenail metrics, elevated concept gathering delvings, conversational questioning inquests, reinforced submersion admeasurements, intense intelligence audits, imposing stress inquiries. War toll includes that for which there is no emoticon. These are all ways that boingboing.net's magical digital New York Times torture euphemism generator has come up with ways that they can avoid calling torture torture. The problem with calling torture torture is everybody knows that torture's against the law, and that if you break the law, the DA and the cops will conspire to grab you and give you at least what seems to be a trial and put you in a cage. That's what happens if you break the law. Especially if you were to, say, I don't know, torture somebody.
I'm Angela Keaton for Liberty Sticker Stuff. Waco, Texas, Heaven's Gate, the Oklahoma bomb. The Desert Storm Syndrome experiment that went wrong. Inject a home because they probably won't come home anyway. The Vietnam conflict was a mere experiment. No. Soldiers came back from the war, couldn't tell you where they went. And commanders. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anna War Radio. I'm Scott. Thanks for tuning in to the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Cindy Corey will be here. Remember the story of Rachel Corey, the young girl who, if she'd been kidnapped by some nobody in Aruba, you would know everything about her. But whose name you may have heard before. She heroically, no hyperbole, put herself between an Israeli army bulldozer and a little Gazan shack that had two little children in it. And so the two little children were spared, but she was not. And George Bush's administration had to say about it just about the same thing that Obama's administration had to say about what happened to Farkan Dogan, who was murdered by the Israeli military on the high seas last spring, shot at point blank range after he was already wounded, laying probably dying anyway on the ground. He was executed. And anyway, I guess as long as you're killed by the Israeli government, the U.S. government doesn't claim a monopoly on the right to prevent that or retaliate for it or anything else. I wonder what would happen if the Iranians murdered an American citizen on the high seas. Shot him to death at point-blank range after he's already laying on the ground, wounded and dying, and if he was even conscious, crying for his mother.
How you think George Bush or Barack Obama, Condoleezza Rice or Hillary Clinton might respond to that? Anyway, her mother, Cindy, is going to be on the show tomorrow to talk about that case. They actually, well, I don't want to ruin it for you, but it's the insult on top of insult is what it is. The so-called process that her grieving family is getting from the Israeli government. Make a mockery. They shouldn't even do it, you know? Don't give us half pretend insulting justice. Just don't. That's my view. Anyway, James Meek will also be here to talk about the war in Afghanistan. Not sure what happened. I think it was supposed to be Monday, but then it didn't work out, but it's going to work out. And I'm going to interview the war nerd from The Exile and The Exiled, Gary Brecher. And he wrote this awesome article called The War Nobody Paid Attention To or something like that. I forget. All about the Iran-Iraq War. And it's, as far as I know of, the most compelling history of that war, short of any books that were written about it that I don't even know of. But it's a hell of an article. Very interesting subject, the Iran-Iraq War. I don't mean George Bush's Iran-Iraq War, George W. Bush's Iran-Iraq War that we fought on Iran's side. I mean Ronald Reagan's Iran-Iraq War that we fought, well, and Jimmy Carter's too, that we fought on Iraq's side. Well, and the Republicans, they armed, as Robert Perry could have told you, they armed the Iranians too. But not nearly as much as they armed Saddam Hussein. Their loyal puppet. So anyway, we'll be talking with the war nerd about that at some point. And Jonathan Landy from McClatchy, formerly from Knight Ridder, which ended up being bought out by McClatchy. Thank goodness somebody saved it. Does Gannett even exist anymore? Hearst, Janes, do they even exist anymore? I don't even know anymore. I think Gannett still does. Anyway, not that they were any good. Knight Ridder was the best in the run-up to the Iraq War, and it's largely because of Jonathan Landy and him and War and Peace Strobel. And they're at McClatchy now, and he's been doing a lot of good work on Afghanistan and Iraq both. And so I'll have some questions for him about some news that he's written. And let's see, I think that's all the announcements I got for now. You mind if I just sit here and say how much fun it is during the show to leave it on MSNBC and just out of the corner of my eye, you know, it's on mute. I don't even bother with the transcript thing at the bottom because who cares? But if something really important happens, I guess it's important to have it on. But I just love seeing Andrea Mitchell host the news out of the corner of my eye during the show. It just gives that extra ironic little oomph that the show needs. You know, as I'm sitting here with the best reporters in the world tearing over the most important issues in the world, and I don't always do the best job. I got a lot of my own things to say, you know, during other people's interviews and whatever. But still, out of the corner of my eye, I've got Alan Greenspan's wife, the single individual most responsible for destroying the American economy and doing so that George Bush could have wars and make them look free. Inflation and war, war and inflation, those two things go together, kids. Do some reading. Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. It wasn't Ben Bernanke. Ben Bernanke actually did the right thing and tried to pop the bubble. He tried to let the air out of it slowly, but that doesn't work. He finally was the one who said, the game is up. We've got to begin to raise interest rates, which he did in the summer of 2008, leading to the popping of the stock market bubble and the housing bubble and all that, and the final destruction of it in September of 2008. So here is the worst person on earth. Here's a man who literally distorted and then destroyed trillions of dollars worth of people's hard-earned money. Trillions. He's destroyed more lives than Dick Cheney did with this war. And in order so that Cheney could destroy the lives that he destroyed with this war. Did I mention that? and then his wife gets to tell me what's important and what's true on TV every day? She gets to be the news anchor interviewing some idiot from the Washington Post about who's ahead in some house race in some state I've never been to? And telling me that this is what matters? Or telling me that, a giant weapon sale to Saudi Arabia is stimulus for our economy? How's that? Does that satisfy anyone out there? I think that's one of the symptoms of empire, that you have so much nepotism. My goodness. It's just ridiculous. The personal relationships between the people who operate the state and the media in this country. I read one thing last week about it's one of these little cupcakes on CNN. I don't mean to be sexist, but I'm just saying she's lip gloss and a hairdo. She's not a journalist. She's an anchor over there at CNN. One of them, I forget her name. And she's married to one of these worst neocon friends of Wolfowitz. Dan Senor, I think. Or one of these horrible warmongers from the American Enterprise Institute. Hell, that guy Robert Blum, who's a war profiteer, sort of the Dick Cheney of the Democratic Party, he has his wife, Dianne Feinstein, sitting in the Imperial Senate. Not just, acting as a lobbyist up there. Zbigniew Brzezinski's daughter hosts the morning show on MSNBC. The Democrats, Kissinger, foreign policy, grand poobah or whatever. Author of The Grand Chessboard, The Arc of Crisis Theory, The New Mackinder Theory, and on and on and on it goes. But I just think particularly the most egregious example has got to be Andrea Mitchell Greenspan. Literally, they're covering economic news in the middle of the day, important news about meetings of, for example, central bankers. And they have Alan Greenspan's wife doing the covering of it, asking those penetrating questions. What can the G20 do to save the world? If only central bankers had more power, then they could fix everything. Isn't that right, Mr. Economy Expert guest on the show? You can't even, get, their housekeeper to be the one. It's got to literally be Greenspan's wife as the one. Is there no such concept anymore of a conflict of interest? I mean, never mind corruption. But just like, hey, you can't have, when the most important story other than the mass murder by the empire around the world is the American economy, you can't have the lady that hosts the news all day long on cable news be the wife of the guy who did this to us, can you? I guess you can. Sorry, it's not all that important compared to all the news this week, but it's kind of funny in a way to me, Eric. Not that I said it in a funny way. Still, yeah, whatever. Hour 3 at LRN.fm coming up next. Chaos Radio Austin, stay tuned for All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Bad news is I tried to call Chris Ketchum, and his phone went right to the voicemail there. So we'll try again in 10 minutes. How about that? I like Christopher Ketchum. And he wrote this thing, Vermont Revolutionaries and the Rise of a Green Tea Party. It's at thehuffingtonpost.com. Of course, Christopher Ketchum has written for antiwar.com in the past, and he's written a lot of great stuff about Israeli spies in the United States, both preceding September 11th and just in general. I remember there's one that I think it's the in general one that begins, scratch a CIA agent. Like they say, scratch something and you see right beneath the surface something. He says, scratch a CIA agent, and he'll start complaining about Israel and the Mossad. And why is that? Because the CIA is just racist? Well, I guess that's possible or something. But no, actually, It's because they know what's going on. At least they know about the things that the Israeli intelligence services do that you and I don't usually get to hear about. And they form opinions based on those things. Imagine that, you know? Anyway, I guess, you know, since this is a talk radio show, I should talk about the midterm elections. Guess what, everybody? I can't remember what 2 years ago was like at all. And I'm pretty sure that the Republicans are awesome. And, man, I hate Barack Obama. He's such a bloodthirsty killer. He does nothing but spend trillions of dollars. Boy, he makes George Bush look like a saver, this guy. As he murders children all day. The child murderer, Barack Obama, and his lickspittle, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi in the Senate and the House of Representatives. Those people deserve to be thrown out of power. High Commander Obama deserves to be weakened by having the opposition party control those houses of Congress. And then good things will happen or something. And, you know, what I wonder, though, really is, how could anybody believe in any of these people or either of these parties? Or for that matter, either of these bankrupt pretended philosophies or ideologies, conservatism and liberalism at this point? Isn't it obvious, even to people who don't care and aren't interested, that we have a one-party state in this society? That the Democrats and the Republicans are simply a front group for big banks, big pharmaceutical companies, big agribusiness companies, and the military-industrial complex? Is there any doubt about that, that Congress is just basically, they're all a bunch of Dianne Feinsteins? They might as well all be married to a guy who gets Pentagon contracts for a living. Why not? Enough of this facade. And the thing is, you know, I used to be a minarchist. I can't justify aggressive, you know, force and all that. And I don't want your sheriff's department to apply to me. I just don't. I'm over it. But, you know, I could see the argument that, look, man, if you're gonna have to have a monopoly on the power to distribute violence around the society, at least it ought to be democratic in the smallest sense. It ought to have regular elections that are respected by those in power. Like, for example, when they lose, leaving office, rather than, going along and understanding that their law didn't pass or whatever, rather than just fighting about it all the time. And it also seems to me that, like, maybe, just maybe, not that it would really be justice, but maybe it could be somewhat workable to have a national defense and a court system and a system of, you know, local police authorities for security forces and stuff, if that was their only job. If those basic security services were their only job, then maybe the democracy, the people, the voters, and their beliefs focused on such few issues could get some things right. Like, how about, for example, we go ahead and legalize being a black person in America? How about we get over that? How about we, at the same time, we force the police to stop abusing the darker pigmented of us? How about we get them to stop treating the white people the same way they've been treating the blacks all along? The blacks. Black people all along. How about we get rid of Wackenhut? How about, as long as we have a socialist security service, shouldn't we maybe have socialist prisons? I mean, the concrete companies and the iron bar manufacturers and Lord knows the prison guard employee unions, you know, have plenty of vested interest in perpetuating the war on us, known as the war on crime, themselves, without actually having the people who own the prison turning a giant profit and turning around and lobbying for more and more draconian laws against more and more basically innocent people. Maybe we could have a system of actual national defense. You know, like maybe we could abolish the Pentagon and the Department of Defense entirely and we could just have our state guard units. and you could volunteer for it, really, 2 weekends a month, 2 weeks a year, and be there in case there's a flood or in case there's such a big bank robbery that the tiny little local sheriff's department can't handle it or something, whatever. If the Chinese come with all those boats they don't have and invade our country, have some guard units. Everybody gets an M16 and good luck landing your boats on our beaches. You know, maybe if we had an extremely limited, hey, how about we could use our democracy to make sure that the judges enforce contracts? Meaning powerful people have to abide by their end of a contract with the weaker party too. Because of some kind of, yeah, right. But anyway, that would be the premise, would be like equal justice under the law. Maybe if those were the only jobs that the government had, maybe we could have a two-party system. Maybe we could have regular elections that would decide these things. And maybe responsible adults doing so could figure out a way to set some things right. But instead, we give government every job in the whole wide world, where now, I swear to God, I could not make this up. I'm telling you, I saw on TV they are passing a federal law against bullying at school. A federal law saying that it's going to be, or at least they're giving out dictates anyway. You all get NED money, you have to do what we say, that kind of loophole. Won't be long before there's an executive order or a presidential decision directive or something. Against bullying at school. Could you imagine bringing even Alexander Hamilton to this day and age and saying, yeah, we still have the same constitution from back then. Look at our government. You wouldn't need Aaron Burr to shoot him in the heart because he would die laughing. By the way, good shot, Aaron Burr. It's preposterous to think we have a rule of law in this society when our government runs the biggest empire in the history of the world. When they pass, when everyone, hey, all 300 million of us know that there are more laws than any of us could ever know, right? That if we are breaking the law, we don't even know it on any given day. If I throw my pizza box in the plain garbage can I go to jail for that? Like, I don't even know. I know it's possible that that's a crime in Los Angeles. I don't know. It might be a federal crime, for all I know. To throw my pizza box in the regular garbage. Who knows? We all know it's like that. Can't leave the house. That's why if you ever meet someone who's FBI agent or a former one or whatever, they'll tell you that, yeah, any FBI agent can destroy the life of any individual by charging them with whatever they want. And, you know, even if you don't go to prison, they'll still tie up your life for 5 years and put you in prison for mail fraud. Did you accept junk mail that arrived in your mailbox? Mail fraud. They'll get you for whatever they want. They don't need a law. All they need is their will. Yeah, anyway, I guess that's all I got to say about that for now. We'll be back with Chris Ketchum after this, I hope. Anti-War Radio.
I'm Mark Stevens, author of Adventure.
Hey kids, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I finally got a second mug full of coffee here. Hang on a second. I keep forgetting to drink this thing. Yeah, that's what I need is, coffee to drink. All right, so, man, darndest thing. What was I watching yesterday? It was some channel. Oh, I know what it was. It was the Lehrer News Hour on PBS, State TV News, Evening News. And at the very end of the show, and maybe they did it earlier in the show too, I don't know, I think I tuned in late, they had their re-news summary of this is what we talked about tonight. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I think it wasn't Jim Lehrer. It was this other guy was doing the final news roundup. I'm not sure. I'm 99% sure it was still the News Hour. But anyway, they played this clip of Hillary Clinton talking about, well, for example, this article in the New York Times. Thank goodness it's not by David Sanger. I don't know who William Young and Alan Cowell are. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt for now. But the article is titled, Iran Begins Loading Fuel at Nuclear Reactor. The reactor building at the Russian-built Bushehr nuclear power plant in southern Iran on Tuesday is the caption on the picture here. And, wow, so now blow me down. Hillary Clinton said, look, this is completely her attitude and her tone of voice and her speech and her body language of waving her hand in dismissal and everything. She says, look, I hear all this media and all this stuff about, oh no, the Bushehr reactor is going online. Well, look, come on. It's not a big deal. Nobody ever said, which, never mind the untruth of that. We're not saying, we never said that they don't have a right to peaceful nuclear technology. Clearly they do. They just don't have the right to build nuclear weapons, she said. Which is, yeah, you know, I don't know. She's a pretty smart lady. I have the idea, you know, I remember her, actually her confirmation hearing for the Secretary of State position showed her to truly be a wonk on a hell of a lot of very important issues, you know. And I'm sure, you know, her staff and the congressional committee types all worked together on which questions they were going to ask and what she needed to really be briefed on. But she really does, you know her stuff. I'm not saying she ain't evil, but I'm just saying she's smart. And anyway, so I think I have to give her the benefit of the doubt that she actually does understand the issue here. So she's being obviously disingenuous by implying that what Iran is doing is making nuclear weapons. It would have been nice if the clip had been longer, would have been even better if the reporters assembled that she was talking to had followed up and said, well, what do you mean? Are you saying the enrichment of uranium at Natanz counts as trying to make nuclear weapons and they have to still stop that, but you don't mind if they use uranium that's already been enriched to fuel the reactor at Bushehr? Is that what you're saying, lady? What exactly are you saying? Because there still is not a shred of evidence anywhere in the world, and no one really even tries to make a compelling case anywhere in the world that there is a secret nuclear weapons program in Iran. There are only innuendos and implications. But really, the nuclear program that they have is the one that everybody in the whole world knows about. The one that you can read all about at the IAEA's website. The one that is declared and safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency under their safeguards agreement, pursuant to their signature and ratification of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. They're not making nuke bombs. They're making industrial-grade uranium-235. That's what they're enriching to. 3.6%. Sometimes as high as 4%. For use in their electricity program. You know, good luck teaching economics to a Republican or a Democrat. But there's a thing called opportunity costs. Like, hey, what if instead of running all of our domestic electricity off of fuel oil, what if we sold that oil and ran our domestic electricity off of uranium? Maybe we could make more money that way. Now, that doesn't mean that the Iranians necessarily are that good at math, and who knows whether they'll really turn a better profit selling more oil on the open market. Guess it depends on how the price is set. But anyway, that's the equation here. And they have plans for a dozen or more nuclear electricity plants across the country for the future. And the Obama administration, just like the Bush administration, has basically pretended as though there is a push toward nuclear weapons technology in Iran. But no, they just haven't shown it. And the best they can do is have the UN Security Council pass resolutions that make a ton of unreasonable demands, illegitimate demands that the UN Security Council has no right to make, that really the United States pushing these Security Council resolutions, and for that matter, Russia, China, Britain, and France going along with it on the Security Council, all of these nations, including our own, are in violation of our own countries, our own government's signatures to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says, as Hillary Clinton mentioned yesterday, guarantees the inalienable right of the Iranians to use nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. So on one hand, she seems to be saying that the American policy is no longer that there may not be nuclear things in Iran, which was basically the Cheney-Bush line. But what is it exactly that she's accepting? Just the Bouchère reactor? What about the enrichment centrifuges at Natanz? They could, in a hypothetical fantasy, once the Iranian government had, if they did, withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty and kick the IAEA inspectors out of the country, which would basically be tantamount to announcing that now they're going to try to make nuclear weapons, they could use those centrifuges to enrich up to above 90% pure uranium-235, which would be weapons grade. Really, it needs to be better than 94%. They could conceivably do that, perhaps. But they're not. They're enriching up to 3.6%. And yeah, there's a little bit of 19.5%, usually rounded up to 20, they say. But those are just tiny little quantities of uranium that are to be used as targets for a medical isotope reactor for cancer treatment. And you know, like radioactive dye, when somebody you love has a heart attack and they put radioactive dye into their bloodstream so that they can track the circulatory system. You know, things that save people's lives. And there's a high demand in the world market for these medical radioactive isotopes. And so anyway, I don't really know what I'm reporting to you guys. I saw Hillary Clinton say something confusing yesterday. She seemed to have been conceding the right of the Iranian government under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to have access to nuclear materials. Would have been nice if she'd gone further and said, we are mandated by the Non-Proliferation Treaty to help Iran develop their peaceful nuclear technology, which is the truth. I guess that could have got her in a little bit of trouble. But the fact remains that the shepherd, neocons, are still crying wolf, and so I have to still cry wolf too. Ladies and gentlemen, there remains a danger, whatever degree, I don't know, that we could have a war with Iran over their nuclear program. So I'm here to explain that what the war party says about it ain't true. And there you have it. We'll be back with more anti-war radio after this.
Free Talk Live.
I have a license. That means you're protected. That's not...
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. No Chris Ketchum. This always happens when I try to interview Chris Ketchum. He's a great writer, but he may be part of a CIA plot to make my show sound disorganized. Hey, guess what? Press TV, that's Iranian State TV, has posted the show on their YouTube channel that I was interviewed for Sunday morning. You want to hear it? Me too.
Hello and welcome to Fine Print with me, Amir Arfa. Today, remember WikiLeaks and the media war it started when it revealed 90,000 U.S. classified documents on the so-called war in Afghanistan? And you remember the video game leaked by WikiLeaks just a few months back? U.S. soldiers playing arcade video games with Iraqi lives on the streets.
Come on, fire!
Hey, Roger.
Time now.
All right, we just engaged all eight individuals.
You know, we got two of ours. We're still firing.
Roger.
Got him. 2-6 is 2-6. We'll move, but we got this.
Oh, fuck, sorry.
Well, it seems like Julian Assange, the founder, is at it again, only this time it's about 400,000 classified reports. Hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. military reports on the Iraq War have been published.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is rejecting all accusations that he has endangered lives by publishing the information.
In our release of these 400,000 documents about the Iraq war, the intimate detail of that war from the US perspective, we hope to correct some of that attack on the truth.
Well, first of all, it's 391,832 reports, most of them filed by soldiers in Iraq. So this is a ground-up report on incidents that took place during this period, with the exception of 2 months. And it's between 2004 and 2009. So it doesn't cover the entire area, the entire period, including the time of the invasion, when there were many more civilian casualties than have been reported.
Yeah, to be honest with you, the timing of this report is very strange. I mean, the political process, in the process to form a government now within the next 2-3 weeks, and we are really surprised about the timing of such reports. Otherwise, there is nothing new. We all knew what the American forces, or the occupation forces, did in Iraq, and we know the mismanagement of the Iraqi government. So nothing new, to be honest, and I don't know what all these propaganda towards this report at this time, at the moment.
But yeah, I think the most important part is the focus on civilian casualties and torture by Iraqi forces, as they call them in there. This is part of what Donald Rumsfeld, back in 2004 and early 2005, called the El Salvador option.
The U.S. government is still seething. Will the publications spark a fresh debate over the horrors of war?
It's shameful that it was ever released to WikiLeaks. It's even more shameful that it's then been published for all the world to see.
Oh, it's simple propaganda to try to divert the story to the character of the man who runs WikiLeaks instead of the information inside the actual war logs. And we saw what they did with the Afghan war. They came up with this phrase, blood on his hands, blood on their hands. And over and over and over again in the American media, the entire right wing and a lot of the news anchors and whatever, they would just use this phrase and just take it for granted that because WikiLeaks had revealed these documents, which included the names of some informers among the Afghans, that therefore these Quislings are being killed.
Right, exactly. The idea is that somehow he's responsible. You know, the Pentagon set up a special war room to deal with WikiLeaks. Basically, WikiLeaks became the enemy, maybe an enemy more serious than the Taliban. They had 120 full-time professionals at a war room. The Central Command in Florida coordinated all of this. There was a unit of American intelligence called the Red Cell Unit, which was monitoring all of these activities.
The reports include compelling evidence of war crimes. Probably the most buzz in the U.S. was generated by those documents detailing the torture and abuse of Iraqi prisoners committed by U.S.-led coalition and Iraqi government forces. Assange said the logs revealed compelling evidence of war crimes that caught the eye of many.
Iraq, as we can see, was a bloodbath on every corner of that country. The stated aims for going into that war of improving the rule of law did not eventuate. And in terms of raw numbers of people arbitrarily killed, worsened the situation in Iraq.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton condemned the leak, as well as Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. ambassador in Iraq.
As a matter of policy, the Department of State does not comment on allegedly leaked documents. I would refer you to the Department of Defense for any further comment. But I do have a strong opinion that we should condemn in the most clear terms the disclosure of any classified information by individuals and organizations, which puts the lives of United States and partner service members and civilians at risk, threatening our national security and the national security of those with whom we are working.
And NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
We take that situation seriously, but I can't comment in details on the exact impact on security. But in general, I can tell you that such leaks are very unfortunate and they may have very negative security implications for people involved.
General Stanley McChrystal, former U.S. Commander-in-Chief in Afghanistan, called it illegal. Similar criticism had come from conservative commentators. Washington Post columnist Mark Thiessen, a member of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute think tank, characterized WikiLeaks as a criminal enterprise and demanded Assange be put on trial. Mike Rogers, a Republican in the House of Representatives, had previously encouraged capital punishment for whistleblowers.
To be honest, we think this is just a cover-up to some more and more crimes happened in Iraq. These criminals, I mean the occupational forces, they did a lot of crimes and killed a lot of Iraqi peoples, and they drained the Iraqi resources as well, from primary administration up to the American forces. So we think this condemned and this call for a trial just to cover up more and more crimes.
All right, y'all. So that was part one of this week's fine print on Press TV. Yeah, I should try to make my answer shorter and sweeter so they don't have to edit me so much. Maybe I need to only do foreign state media when I have an agreement that we're going out live. Not that I was taken out of context or anything, not so far. Just check out the second clip when we come back from this break. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm going to be on Ernie's show late this afternoon, 2 o'clock.
On Free Talk Live, we talk...
All right, y'all, wrapping up Anti-War Radio for the day. I will be back on LRN.FM at 2 o'clock. I think that means my time, West Coast time, here in California, on Ernie Hancock's show. Looking forward to talking with my friend Ernie again. Also, by the way, I don't think I said on this show, but they're replaying this show 5 days a week now at night from 10 to midnight East Coast time. You do all your own calculations. There's only four time zones unless you count Newfoundland or Brazil or some crap. They're replaying anti-war radio, I mean to say, every night from 10 to 1. Thanks to Mark and Ian for that. All right, so hey, you want to hear part two of the show that I was interviewed on Sunday morning for Iranian State TV? I do.
They have to take responsibility for what these soldiers did. Also, they reported on these abuses to their superiors, the U.S. soldiers did, but nothing was ever done. So the U.S. was complicit in all of this, and that has to be made clear, that this was a case of torture. And this is the kind of controversy in America, because the New York Times has sort of downplayed all of this, downplayed the suggestion of torture. And instead refers euphemistically to other things. 15,000 civilian casualties have been confirmed as higher than what the U.S. reported. But the U.S. has always downplayed the number of casualties, so it's not surprising that there are more. In fact, there are estimates that are much higher, because these casualties could only be as a result of combat. What about people who died from their wounds, who died from a lack of medical care, a lack of food, the conditions in Iraq, and the rest?
Seen that there are approximately 15,000 never previously documented or known cases of civilians who have been killed by violence in Iraq.
I think they know the number, but they don't release it. And to be honest with you, we don't believe about this play between WikiLeaks and the American government. They try to give the impression that this is the real numbers and we don't accept this as the American government. But we think or we believe that the American forces and the American administration knows exactly what the Iraqi civilian casualties number, but they don't release the actual numbers because of the chaos of the situation, and they want to keep their reputation within the international community. But we believe that the numbers are much, much more, either from the American forces or the linked terrorists or the private security companies.
No closure or moving on from this or any war until every last victim has been properly recognized and the full details of the circumstances of their death acknowledged. These logs are potentially the largest single contribution to achieving that goal that has ever been published.
It's clear that the documents from WikiLeaks reveal that the Pentagon has been lying about their own numbers. And if you look at iraqbodycount.org, they're at just about 100,000 now. And that's the most conservative estimate possible of individual verified cases of civilian casualties. But as you mentioned, in 2004 and in 2006, Lancet and Johns Hopkins did studies that put the figure in 2004 at over 100,000 and in 2006 at over 655,000. And then the end of 2007, Alan Hyde, who's the director of Opinion Business Research, financed his own study. It wasn't George Soros money or anything. He financed his own study to measure the rate of excess deaths, that is, the rate of death of Iraqis above and beyond how the rate at which they were dying before the war, which I'll remind your audience was still under a blockade that killed a million people. So the rate of excess deaths above and beyond the Clinton-era blockade caused by this war had led Alan Hyde and his researchers to conclude that a million people had been killed as of the fall of 2007. And what Opinion Business Research did was they said, you know what, that's a really big number. Let's make sure. And they stopped doing any press. I think they only did one or two interviews in the fall of 07. And Alan Hyde sent his people back to Iraq to do the study again to make sure. And they came back in the spring of 2008 with the number, yes, a million Iraqis who otherwise would have been alive, comparing the rates of death, had died. And so that includes people who couldn't get to the hospital because of all the checkpoints in the way. And that includes people that died of typhoid and cholera because of America's destruction of their water supplies. And that's not just, you know, civilian Iraqis murdered or killed directly by American soldiers, but it's the number of Iraqis who died as the result of the war.
We could assure you that from the occupation date, 2003, till now, more than 1 million and few hundreds thousand Iraqis has been killed by either the occupation forces or the terrorists that's linked to the occupation in Iraq.
1,421,933 Iraqis have fallen dead due to U.S. invasion of their country. So many conflicting reports, so many conflicting numbers on casualties, civilian casualties in Iraq. The reason? No officials have been counting. No American officials have been counting Iraqi civilian deaths.
Well, as we see from these WikiLeaks papers, they do, in fact, count civilian casualties. Tommy Franks was simply lying when he said, we don't do body counts. Yes, of course they do body counts, and these documents prove they do body counts. But, of course, their numbers are way low. First of all, they're measuring actual deaths from actual battles rather than the rate of excess deaths in the overall society. So it's sort of apples and oranges in terms of the numbers. But also, as we're well aware, the soldiers have testified over and over again. If they kill the innocent person, they just drop a shovel next to him and say he was planning an IED, drop an AK-47 next to him and say that he was an insurgent. That happened over and over again. In fact, I'd like to recommend to your audience a wonderful book, horrible book, by Chris Hedges and Leila Al-Aryan called Collateral Damage. And it's nothing but stories, firsthand stories from American soldiers describing, frankly, the war crimes that they committed in Iraq. And it's divided in checkpoints, in divided by conflicts that happen at checkpoints, during the convoys across the country, house-to-house raids and searches and the humiliations that took place in people's houses. And it's called Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraq's Civilians. And it's all firsthand accounts from American soldiers, as verified as absolutely possible by former New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. And that will bring the truth of the horror of the Iraq War, which, after all, the Ba'ath Party and its army were destroyed in 3 weeks. The rest of this entire war was against Iraqi civilians who dared to defend their country from foreign occupation.
Most surprisingly of all, we have found a huge number of names of victims meticulously recorded in these logs. It's unclear to us why the U.S. Army wanted to go to such lengths in its recording, but it is of huge public importance and interest that it did. Names are the gold dust of casualty recording enterprise, and the only certain route to a full and final death toll that will satisfy all parties, including bereaved families.
Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrill told CNN, "This is all classified secret information, never designed to be exposed to the public. Our greatest fear," he said, quote, "is that it puts our troops in even greater danger than they inherently are on these battlefields."
The bottom line is, our forces are still very much in danger here as a result of this exposure, given the fact that our tactics, techniques, and procedures are exposed in these documents, and our enemies are undoubtedly going to try to use them against us and making their jobs even more difficult and dangerous.
Well, that was very considerate of Iranian state TV to give the last word to the Pentagon there. It seems like there's an easy answer to that. Stop occupying people's countries, and it doesn't matter what your tactics for occupying their countries are. So all this hasn't been transparent all along for anyone who cared to look. Or hell, cared to spend a half hour a week listening to this show. Anyway, so I'm glad they included that much of what I had to say about Iraqi civilian casualties. As I predicted on my Facebook page a couple of days ago, they cut out, I said the El Salvador option, but then they cut the part about what that meant. And that meant hiring the pro-Iranian Shiite death squads of the Badr Corps of the Supreme Islamic Council, the Mahdi Army of Muqtada. Oh, that was interesting. Lost my connection there for a minute. Anyway, so that's kind of cool. I should do those shows live, though, I think.